How do you know when to start?
Do you want to gather around again, if you want?
Yeah, get closer if you want.
Okay, so we go on. So this session is called, How Do We Know When to Stop? And I think we were asked to think about modes of repetitive or habitual sort of individual and social practices and ways of being, and how they have something to do with the question of limits. So I guess this is a conversation between Bron and myself about really knowing when to stop and what that has to do with working out what to preserve and what to jettison in order for new forms of thinking and action to develop. So it has something to do with acknowledging a limit to what's possible within one form of being, one way of thinking and doing, one form that life takes, and the capacity to take a different direction, or to go astray, or to begin anew. So it's a question, I think. Do new forms of action have to break through a limit, in the sense, say, of revolt or of revolution? Do they retreat from a limit, in the sense of pulling back or accepting that we can't have and be everything? Do they come about through cultural, social forms of working through, which is what I've been trying to argue for, the sort of going over and over without goal or aim, which is the struggle with resistance? Working through has to do with the repetitions of resistance to what can feel unbearable to know about. I think we can think about forms of action that break through limits within the paradigm of the event. And we can think about modes of becoming that eschew the event, whereby change is imminent to all systems in motion and in flux. And Bron's amazing piece really showed this. But the temporality of working through is neither event nor becoming. I would say it's a form of time suspension that allows a chronic action to not unfold. So I'm curious then, not so much about how we know when to stop, but with the temporality of stopping. Stopping as a psychosocial practice that has duration, like waiting and staying and delaying and preserving and repeating and remembering and maintaining and ending. The suspended temporalities that I would argue constitute care, including the ways that we may attempt to take care of time at this particular cultural juncture. These are obdurate temporalities. They have none of the allure of the time of rupture, epochal shift or change. They involve social practices that are mostly arduous and boring and mundane, or simply unbearable. They require a certain staying power, in particular staying alongside others, staying with processes that appear repetitive and stuck and unchanging, or staying with certain ideas that may no longer be in date and therefore appear anachronistic or out of time. So the social forms that these elongated temporalities might take include looking after the dead through various practices of grief work, looking after those who we come to name and claim as our children through the long timelines of parenting, keeping safe political ideas that appear to no longer have efficacy in the now, in the belief that they may in the future become useful again, the useless, open-ended, ongoingly dying practice of psychoanalysis, and many varieties of maintenance work with all the gendered, classed, and raced implications of that work that prop up the lives of others and the social institutions that support them. They produce felt experiences of time not passing, of time in suspension. We could think of many concrete examples where stopping is a kind of substitution, the deviation from killing to talking during a peace process, the the phasing out of harmful or cruel practices towards others in the name of less harmful ones, and so on. But if the temporality of stopping has something to do with suspension, with waiting, then it might also be about bearing the interval, the time of not knowing what comes after. Brian.
Great, thanks for a great introduction. And so particularly after reading your wonderful book, Enduring Time, from a couple of years ago, I immediately started seeing some connections I could offer between your ideas of human suspended time with my own work on the temporalities and becoming of animate and inanimate matter. So in thinking about that, I thought it might be useful to introduce three concepts which might be useful to think with and to try and weave with your own ideas. So three main concepts, and those are, well, it's a Greek term, and excuse my ancient Greek. Maybe ancient, but I'm not an ancient Greek. So the first concept is energeia, from the work of Aristotle in his Metaphysics and De Anima, and the second is the middle voice, which is a linguistic concept, the idea of voice as opposed to active or passive voice. So energeia, the middle voice, and the final is a neologism of my own, which is drift work. So I'll just go through those three, and then we'll sort of see how, and then I know you're going to have your own response, and then we'll open it up for discussion. So, energeia. So, as developed by Aristotle, we can contrast that with many other terms, but particularly I'm thinking of kinesis, so which is where we get the word kinetic from. So, kinesis is motion or change understood as motion, but particularly the way Aristotle develops it, it is the way that something that's potential becomes actual. So the kind of easiest ways to examples to think of an activity as a kinesis are those activities that have an end product. So for example, my traveling to Berlin for this event, during my travel, it was all potential. I was potentially in Berlin, and that's why I was traveling to Berlin, and that gave the meaning to my what I was doing. And as soon as I get to Berlin, then my being in Berlin is actualized, and then the potential disappears, and so I stop traveling, you know, because it loses its point. It has a natural finish. To use one of these words, you know, to stop and finish, and that's a kind of a near synonym in English, but finish isn't quite the same, and I think your use of agamben in the talk before is a good way of thinking about how certain ways of coming to a stop are different to others, and they, you know, take time in different ways. So energeia, as opposed to this kinesis, which has this end product, is a different kind of activity with a different temporality. And the sort of examples you were talking about, grieving, parenting, also friendship, our enthusiasms, what makes life worthwhile and everything, are activities that they're not a means to an end. So there is never, that's an end in another sense of stop, not stop end, but end as in the point, you know, the purpose. So there's never an end point in the temporal sense where they come to a natural finish and become pointless in the way that my traveling to Berlin lost its point when I got to Berlin, as it were. So those differences between finishing and stopping in English is a way of capturing it. You know, you finish washing the dishes because you've washed the last dish, but some things don't come to a finish, and you just may or may not continue, or you just have to stop at some point. Anyway, but we can get into the complexities of those words. And in linguistically speaking, when we describe these energeia kind of processes, which are an end in themselves, they're what makes life pointful, if you like, rather than being the means to an end, grammatically, in some languages, we have this imperfective aspect, which is used for ongoing, i.e. never-ending, or habitual, that we repeated, you know, we keep doing it, or actions. And we don't really have a proper imperfective in English. The closest is the past progressive, like we say, often in the past tense we use it, so she was reading a book rather than she read the book. So she read the book, it's a completed action, but she was reading, it's ongoing. We don't know if it'll ever come to an end. Is it a book with an end? We're not told. Could be either. But so if we describe an action in the perfective, she read a book, it's a closed book. The action is a closed book. The covers are closed. We can't see inside it. And we generally view from the end of the book, the back cover, if you are looking back, you know, we look back at this as a finished action. But in the imperfective, the reading is maybe endless. And we enter the activity by describing it like that. So we say, he was reading a book, he was thinking, we are conversing. And those gerund words, which have in English the ing on the end, is we enter into this activity, and maybe it doesn't have an end point outside itself. And it kind of makes the activity like an environment which we inhabit, a surrounding milieu in which other actions can take place and other kinds of activities, you know, like your work on, I know you're going to talk about it later, the maternal death drive and this kind of idea. So when we say, for example, a sentence like, it was raining when he knocked on the door, it was raining is the imperfective, and it's like an environment. We're sort of invited into this setting where other things can take place, other forms of activity, such as knocking on the door or watering the plants in the rain, if that's Roxy Boat, etc. And the name imperfective is really interesting. It's got that im, that negation at the beginning. And in Polish, the word is niedokonany, which means unfinished or unaccomplished, as if we haven't yet done what we're trying to do. And I think there's something deceptive about that term, and it points to a needed transvaluation where we need to see not kinesis, i.e. a completable action, as the paradigm form of action for humans or other things, but energeia, as the sort of the got a more fundamental term. So energeia, so maybe the name for this aspect of language, so maybe not this imperfect in the imperfective or the unfinished, the niedokonany in Polish, but actually maybe unfinishable, and thereby paradoxically complete in itself, because it's not awaiting completion by an end result, but it's complete all, you know, it's like English rock, seaside rock. It's got complete all the way through, not just printed on the end when you get to the end of it. You cut into the rock and the word goes all the way through. So I think it's, we need to rename these voices. Okay, so for example, I am happy to be talking with you all the way through this conversation, not just expecting to be happy at the end when I have talked to you and somehow got to some point of the conversation. And this is where we can start to go beyond the human, possibly, you know, because I think our animal bodies, and there's been a few animal bodies wandering around in various states of undress today, and I think the shape of our bodies seem almost to bias us towards kinesis, this end means end kind of ways of thinking. So to generalize, animals such as us are mortal individuals. We have fixed body plans, more or less, once we've matured. Are mobile, and we eat other organic things and store energy internally. So our metabolism is what Hans Jonas calls a needful freedom. We eat to move, and we move to eat. And this is topological, it shapes our bodies and our fundamental experience of being in the world. So this furniture that we're sitting on, it has two axes of symmetry. You know, this side's the same as that side, and this side's the same as that side. So it kind of looks like an animal, a quadruped, but it could go in either direction, or maybe it could scuttle that way like a crab, you know, whereas our bodies are biased in a certain kind of direction. You know, we're bilaterians. We have left-right symmetry. Well, except when I smile and then it's exposed that my face is not symmetrical, as my daughter over there knows too well. But we're asymmetrical vertically and front to back, you know. And around these various bodily axes are organized the human body's various organs of metabolism. I could do with them some food actually soon. I keep forgetting to eat today. Motion, perception, communication, and manipulation, and so on. And this shapes our experience of time. Humans typically imagine time as a spatial dimension. You know, we talk about going forward. You know, we're held back, we put the clocks back, we bring meetings forward for some reason, too often. We're moving onwards, we're approaching the end of our conversation, we're moving towards it. As time goes past us, we seem to imagine it as another body. And what we experience first, we say, is before the front of this time coming towards us, and then we experience what is after, the back. And we use the body's asymmetrical spatial topology to express how time can evolve, not just motion and change, but also knowledge and ignorance. You know, so is the future behind us or in front of us? Different Latin American languages, the future is behind us because we can't see it. You know, so we use the body to express, anyway, all this stuff. So that's animals. Yeah, but we've had enough of animals today. So let's think about plants. So how might other kinds of organisms that don't have this kind of body plan and this way of experiencing the world, the experience of time, waiting, the potential, the actual, and so on. And Michael Marder is the great plant philosopher. Well, he's not a plant, he's a philosopher, but he's a plant philosopher. Well, I've not met him. I presume he's a plant philosopher in a hyphenated way. And his great book, Plant Thinking, from 2013, argues that the plant's embeddedness in place weds it to what he calls heterotemporality. And I think that's another concept, really, that's really useful for the conversation today. So the time of a plant is not its own. It can never be its own. It has to be oriented to the other of light and seasons and precipitation. It's always oriented to the other, fundamentally. Not another that is born inside itself, but another that it is always aware of outside. And unlike the animal with its separate rhythms, like us, of eating, digesting, and expending energy, for plants, nourishment, growth, and activity is continuous and potentially infinite, never satisfied or pausing or giving space for other kinds of pursuits like animals can do. And the plant's endless repetition as it grows of leaf and bud, leaf and leaf and leaf, and another leaf. And, oh, bugger it, let's have another leaf, you know, it's never ending. Bud and branch is akin to Nietzsche's eternal return, so different from the heroic human for whom repetition can only be a kind of tragic failure of accomplishment, you know. Anyway, so, okay, I'm probably taking too long. I'm waiting for my, you can flash me a 5-minute symbol in a minute if you want. So that was Energeia. So the point about kinesis, as I said, during the action, it's all potential. You know, I'm making a chair. It's the potential, and then it's actualized at the end. The point about energeia is the potential and the actual are coexisting all the way through, like the writing in the English rock. And that is plant being. You know, there's no time when it's actualized, it's completed, or it can rest, and so on. And I think so. The plant is a good can teach us about energeia as this more fundamental form of time, and the middle voice is a second idea, which is not so strong in modern European languages. So the English language has the two voices: the active voice, I pick up the pen, or the passive voice, the pen is picked up by me, and the two actions look the same. They're just looked at from two ends of a radical dichotomy between those things in the world which we think are active, are agents, have will, and those things which are just passive, the environment, if you like. So they starkly divide the environment into these active and passive elements. And the middle voice, which you do get in ancient Greece, in Sanskrit, Bengali, and some Amerindian languages and so on, doesn't divide the world in this way. So the middle voice emphasizes, it's neither an active nor passive, but it emphasizes that most of what happens in the world does not involve a heroic agent imposing their active will on a passive environment, but is a collaboration. It's always a collaboration, an interaction which entangles the body in its milieu. And so middle voice creeps into our ways of seeing and acting in the world, even in those languages which don't really have a well-developed middle voice like English. So I am talking to you is active voice, but you are listening to me is a kind of middle voice, because listening is doing something. It's you, Lisa, that's listening. You're not being listened by something else, but listening opens you up to alterity, to the wider situation, like the heterotemporality of plants, you know, receiving the gift of the sun and the rain and so on. And the key words that you use in your own work and that you've recited earlier, you know, the waiting, the staying, the delaying, the enduring, persisting, as well as having that gerund form ending in ing that just suggests the imperfective and energia, are also weighted towards the middle voice, neither passive, having something done to you, nor active, doing something when you're in control. And I think the reason you had to write this wonderful book about them and gather them together as a phenomenon of enduring time is surely that we've forgotten how fundamental the middle voice is to human experience, and I would say to more than human experience. And my work on drift picks up on this. So I define drift as a sort of more than human phenomenon, as the motion of solid bodies moving through moving fluids, such that the resulting motion is due to the play between the body and its surrounding medium. For example, things being washed down a river or lifted by the wind, and human bodies, we're megafauna, so it's harder for us to drift in the way that small things can. But I argue that drift is the primordial form of motion, relating to my argument about energia, that long predates powered locomotion from point to point, and is still how most motion of solid entities occur in the Earth. And to describe drifting and floating, we naturally adopt the middle voice. We say a sea drifts in the air or floats in the water. It's not just pushed by the air. It's not forced to flow like the surrounding fluid, but neither is it in control of its actions, which result from the play between the object and medium. And I think attending to how things drift can help us to make sense of forms of human time and action and thought that don't power themselves heroically to an end of this sentence, but are entangled in their conditions of possibility such that it's impossible to say who acts. And I think, going towards a conclusion, just because drift is middle voice, the play between body and environment, and is not this heroic, you know, imposition of the will, doesn't mean that drift can't be put to work. And I think there's some other connections, and we talked over breakfast about how this might connect with some of your concepts, because both living and non-living entities and systems can engage in what I call drift work, as a single word, in which drift is subsumed within a wider set of purposes or functions. You know, it seems like a paradox, or a, what's the word? I can't think of the word, of the contradiction in terms. Put these two words together, to do drift, to drift and to work. But this is possible because drift built the world that we inhabit. The push, you know, continental drift. Continent people, you're all here and you've drifted to Berlin. You know, drift built our world, pushing up mountains, concentrating minerals, laying down and building up sedimentary rocks and soil. So the world we inhabit was built by drift. Things without limbs also use drift to disseminate plants and seeds and fungi, spores. And things like us with limbs, with the ability to steer and propel our bodies, can withhold that power like we're doing now, sitting on these benches. Birds can hold their wings still and drift through rising air. Shoppers in a marketplace can put drift to work, allowing them to be pulled this way and that, to discover things by chance and accident. And as we rest or fold our limbs, we turn ourselves into a washload to be carried, not exactly like the currents around us, but in the middle voice and then perfective aspect of absorption. And in creative thinking and discoursing, we allow our minds and our interactions to drift, to cross the streamlines of directed, purposive thought, so that we can hopefully find new possibilities.
A bit talked out anyway, and that was so beautiful.
Where's the bar?
I kind of, this is not scripted, but I wonder if we should just
bring people in.
I don't know if people want to allow their minds to drift, but if you have any thoughts that you want to share from the sessions before and this one, I guess we're trying to deal with this question about not how do you know when to stop, but what is the practice of stopping? And what is its temporality? And what is its relation to ending? You know, if we do think about, you know, in a really bold way, whether we're living in the end times of the human life form, as many people think we are, then what is the temporality of ending in relation to stopping? There seems to be an imperative to stop doing various things that are contributing to the ending. Yeah? But what does that mean, stopping, as opposed to the stop? I think that's what we're trying to open up as a question.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, let's situate this in the current political and eco-political context, and how can we use some of these, this sort of rich, you know, set of concepts that have come out of this dialogue, to help us think about in what ways we need to stop in order to be able to continue, and you know, to stop the things we need to stop, as it were, and so on. So, yeah, any.
I know you're not mic'd up, but just shout out. Elizabeth. Hello. Do you want to say something?
How are you?
Good.
Oh, I'm mic'd.
You're got a mic'd, so go for it.
Yeah, come join the conversation.
What?
Do you want to say something?
Oh, sure. well, I was actually, I was actually thinking. And I fear I might repeat myself later, but why not? That the question of enduring and the question of the rich way in which the question of ends stopping was related to the stone was super interesting to me. In ways I'll talk about it later, but in the vocabulary that you guys are using, there are two contexts in which I've lived in which the end's already happened. So different than stopping, right? But a certain way of thinking about the end. One was from my paternal side, in which a little village in the Alps that sat right on the other side of the Italian in the First World War, so it sat in the Austrian-Hungarian and then just on the other side. So it was just this place of slaughter, and then in some ways it disappeared. The village is there, but a certain kind of referent was gone. And the second, of course, is the context of settler colonialism, in which things endure, right? But the end already happened. So I'm not the only one that says this. Like, there's, you know, if we want to know what the end's going to be like, there are a lot of people who have had to live after the end, after the catastrophe, and that are already living. But what was interesting to me is that in both of those contexts, the way of being or enduring after the end, when you're living after the end, is not hope, and it's not a form of staying in the repetition, but rather a radical form of stubbornness that is paradoxical in its enunciation. For instance, we were taught from my grandfather and my grandmother, who lived after the end, to form ourselves into a kind of subject who would say this: you can kill me, but I'm not going anywhere. And there, I mean, we've, in Australia, where, you know, I've spent a long time, there are very similar kinds of things that we say, and there are very similar kinds of practices of child raising that intend to build this kind of subject that says you can take everything, but we're not going anywhere, right? More like a rock, right? So what happens when we start thinking about questions of end, questions of stopping? Because you're right, Bronislaw, the rock doesn't stop, right? outside of this idea of finitude, this idea of death, this idea of right, and instead we take a lesson from the rock and mold ourselves into something that remains, even if in a dispersed form. You cut it, it might disperse in a different form, but remain. So I guess it was really, it was super interesting to me. And those were just, I don't know if it's a question, obviously not a question, but it was thoughts. Sorry.
I mean,
just wind Beth up and she'll talk.
Just a response. So this is a really interesting slippage. So I think what Bron was referring to in terms of rock is a suite that gets sold in Brighton on the seafront. And when you cut through it, the word is the same every time you cut. So it's really interesting, nice slippage.
Yes, sorry, I'm half deaf.
No, that's the same word, right?
Made
it's
of
the
sugar.
Same word.
Yes.
Okay, it's rock. But in a way, it's a reminder that, as we know, rock is not as rock-like as we think it is, right?
Or, I would say we're more rock-like than we think we are.
Right, okay. So
I always am going to go that other way.
Yeah. So I think there's a really interesting sort of tension opening up between, if you like, let's call it depression, as a kind of practice of endurance.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, exactly, as a kind of withdrawal or retreat to a place that solidifies something that we might think of as having some kind of value. And perhaps...
We've got another question, another intervention over there.
Okay, some interventions.
Excellent.
Okay,
turn me off.
Yeah, sorry for turning you off. Just coming back to the original question of like where our minds wandered. Basically, like, I've been here since 3, and like around 8, my stomach started to, like, I don't know, tell me that it's maybe, like, I also had the choice of either enduring it until the end, or like just, you know, taking a break and stop. And like, that's just a very practical example of like knowing when to stop, I guess. Like, I just took a break for like 40 minutes and had some food, and now I'm back. So I can, I don't know, continue this task or this action that's not really, you know, doesn't really have an end. And I think it's something that, you can apply it to pretty much everything. You can just listen to your stomach and feel like when it's time to stop, right? And it's for that to do it, like, or so it's okay to do it, you need to have some kind of culture of acceptance, you know? So it's okay to just take a break, to just stop whatever you're doing. And when it's washing the dishes, like when you're living with other people, you know, it should be fine if you're just bored washing dishes to just stop, you know, but because if you're always finishing, if you're always enduring it during the end, then at some point, you know, they're building up tensions. And if there's no culture of acceptance, no culture of like being okay to just stop when you feel like it's enough, like, I think that's really important. That's where my mind went.
The washing dishes is such a culturally overloaded, like, where did you get that from? Like, somewhat, you know, that's the whole point, right?
Kind of worms.
Around reproductive labor, like, you can't stop washing you don't necessarily have a choice to take a break. So that's another tension that's opening up around the question of stopping. Because I completely agree with you. I really need a break. I've been here since 10.
Right?
But at the same time, that part of what we're doing is acknowledging that there are communities of care that develop around the fact that a break is not possible. So then how does one endure the time of care through rock-like persistence? And also its dissolution, the points in which rock-like persistence turns out not to be as rock-like as we hoped.
Got another intervention over there.
It's only a very short one, and I think it's more just a reflection on the words that I've been listening to. And you just said it then when you talked about choice. And I think for me, I was thinking about the control. So who has the choice? And what choices would you impose upon yourself? And what are external that can control or shift the power dichotomy between the question of how do you know when to stop, or how does something else inform that? That was just something that I picked up on whilst listening.
else.
Well, and I think Bronn's amazing. Oh, I think you were also involved, these images of self-organizing systems in which you won't be able to locate agency in that direct way, but things occur in which choices get made that seem to come out of a different kind of logic. I mean, you could speak to that better than I could.
Definitely. And I think, it's a kind of a systems perspective. I suppose it's a cybernetic-y kind of way of thinking where, attributing a decision to an agent is seen as it's literally that, an attribution, and it's something which often is after the event, or it's a particular way of doing a cut through this middle voice kind of entanglement where we attribute those kind of moments of decision, not exactly arbitrarily, and because there's a danger here, because, that can seem to imply we don't hold people accountable for their actions, because they were only obeying orders, like the particles in the rings, they're just following the rules, so that's all, that can be problematic. But I think, can I just go back to washing the dishes, actually, because I want to tell a story, because in Lancaster, in Lancaster we have, my favourite shop is Wilkinson's, which is a kind of hardware shop, sort of budget hardware shop, some of you will know Wilkinson's, and so the ground floor of Wilkinson's is where you top up on the products you need to do reproductive labour, basically. It's the things that wear out all the time, things like cleaning products, gardening, things like that, and so on. All this kind of all your ings, are on the ground floor. On the first floor is kind of durable objects. And I don't know who decided that and whether it's the same in other towns, but I started noticing that. So that's where you go for things which are supposed to have a lifespan, not of weeks and months, but, have this residency time in the technosphere, which is more generational level, where you buy light switches or, things like that, appliances and machines like that. Okay, so the point is, and some of you might be starting to see this. So Hannah Arendt in 1958 wrote this amazing book called The Human Condition, where she talked about these three sort of paradigmatic forms of human action, which are labor, work, and action. And this is where, she's distinguishing, sort of against Marx, clarifying Marxist thought, that labor and work are different, because work is about the end product and creating a durable object, which is not, and I was doing it down, but basically it's really important because, look, this is a work, this building, and it's a great setting and everything. These are important that people make these durable things. My dad was an engineer, and I, big respect and everything. But writing a book, we call it a work, because it's an end product, and these things are important, they're enduring things. But labor is endless. It's the endless care work and the endless reproductive work, which never ceases. And it is more, she makes the connection with the natural world there. But action's really, that's where politics happens. That's where we act in concert and we create language and we tell stories and we do politics and things like that. So I've got this fantasy that there's a third floor to Wilkinson's and it's a political debating chamber, and I've just never found the escalator that goes up to the third part of the Hannah Arendt's Human Condition. But it must be there.
I'm going to take one last point from Kaushik.
So I was thinking with this question, how do you know when to stop? Two things that one cannot ask this question of are capital and a cancer cell, because both of them by definition do not know when to stop accumulating, when to stop metastasizing, when to stop appropriating. And so by definition, if they knew when to stop, they wouldn't be capital and a cancer cell. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking, when one thinks of something like cancer and something like chemotherapy as a counter to cancer, then of course, a successful chemotherapy might defeat the cancer, but very rarely without doing injury to the thing that it is meant to save. And this made me think about how a certain idiom of politically thinking anti-capitalist politics through the 20th century especially was revolution.
Yeah.
And I was thinking it's hard for me to think of a single revolution that hasn't done some serious injury to that which it was meant to save. Yeah. And so I'm wondering, Bron, whether in pushing us to think with something like drift, you're also opening up a thought of an anti-revolutionary politics, not a counter-revolutionary one, but something that thinks other temporalities. And this also made me think, Lisa, of what you were saying in the previous session of wanting to think beyond a crisis, anti-crisis dichotomy, and whether that's
right.
Something you're opening us up to.
Should we leave that as a final comment?
Yeah. That's great.
We had this super pretentious plan that we were going to like debate the fact that we've been talking about stopping and finishing and ending, and how are we going to stop and finish and end this talk and blah blah blah. But actually, we're just going to end it and hand over.
End, yeah, not finish, because there's no finish.